This is The Agenda. Local newsmakers, community leaders, and people in our valley making a difference. Here's your host, Dave Bernstein.
All righty, happy Friday, and thanks for joining us on the program today. We have 12th District State Senator Brad Hawkins joining us. Lots to talk about, and next month the legislature convenes, and so we can do a little bit of preview on some key things. Also, before we get started on that, I'll say welcome. Thanks for coming in studio.
Thank you for having me, Dave. It's great to be in studio with you, and Merry early Christmas to all the KPQ listeners.
Yeah. Real quick, I think there are going to be a little different rules because of COVID in the Senate and the House, I think I recall.
Right.
And what's that going to mean for folks that might want to testify? I guess we have had the, you know, kind of the Zoom participation, mm-hmm. and maybe that's kind of a good thing. But in terms of people coming and watching, or what's the difference between the House and the Senate rules?
Well, it's going to be a little bit different this year. It's actually going to be better for the Senate because last year, even though it was billed as kind of a hybrid, it was almost an entirely virtual remote legislative session with very limited participation on the Senate floor. So this year, we are going to conduct the committee hearings and constituent meetings by Zoom. So those will continue to be remote. But the floor debates and the floor action will be in person. We have to wear masks or certain protocols. And they are allowing people in the galleries to a certain extent to view the public process and the floor debate. So in that sense, it's more of a true hybrid legislative session. And it's only 2 months this year, so it'll go fast. But I do look forward to it.
So in-person debate.
Floor debate, yeah.
That seems to me to be better than doing it via Zoom. I don't know why. What is your impression?
Yeah, it works surprisingly well by Zoom. But, you know, when it comes to the floor debates, there are usually a lot of amendments. There's give and take with your colleagues. And there's a lot of sidebar discussions. There's just a sort of action that goes on that's very characteristic of the state Senate that occurs when all of the members of the state Senate are on the floor. We're taking the floor. We're debating. And there's sort of a natural interaction and a flow of debate and public dialogue that I think is important to the process. And so I'm excited for that. As far as the remote committee hearings, people will still be able to participate from all over the state like they have. And for the most part, that's worked pretty well. And even this year, it'll be the second time around. So I think the Senate will be even more fine-tuned when it comes to the technology use.
Different rules, though, over in the House, though, I think,
yep.
Right?
Yeah, more strict. I think it's almost entirely virtual in the House of Representatives. And so I'm just thankful that, you know, it's not exactly what we wanted in the Senate, but it's an improvement over last year. And this year, like I said, will go by really fast because the legislature is having the short session this year. And some people may not realize, but according to our Washington State Constitution, the state of Washington has the legislators in session for part of the year, but we alternate between longer sessions when we're developing and debating the state's two-year budgets, and then shorter sessions, which are 60 days in the shorter sessions, when we're in between that budget year, just basically making modest adjustments to the existing budgets. And so that's what we're looking at for January of 2022. The session begins January 10th. It runs for 60 consecutive days. And when you back out the weekends, we're not always there on the weekends. So it's a lot is happening. And what that tends to do is really compress the deadlines for bills to get out of committee, for bills to make it off the floor, for bills to be considered in the House. And so any little hiccup can kind of compromise a piece of legislation, but hopefully we'll just make some minor adjustments to the existing budgets and get out of there on time.
We're going to kind of jump around to a lot of different things. We'll talk about the whole 12th district, redrawn the district here in just a bit. But I want to start with something just real fresh, and that is a school district consolidation bill that you are proposing. And when you take a look at how much some schools are spending per pupil versus others, The idea is there could be some real cost savings. So tell us a little about the bill that you're, I think you've already filed this?
Yeah, I pre-filed the bill for the legislative session. It will be bipartisan. I serve as the ranking member of the Education Committee in the Senate. And of course, I have a background in education, 10 years on school boards, both the Eastmont School Board and the North Central Educational Service District Board before getting elected to the State House. And basically, when you look at the data will indicate that the smaller school districts tend to have higher per student costs than medium or average size school districts. So, for example, that the average per student costs across the entire state of Washington, all 295 different districts, I think is about $14,000. You probably have the figures there. Yeah. Eastmont is a little bit lower than that, and Wenatchee is a little bit higher. And but then when you look at the smaller school districts like Lake Chelan, Manson, particularly getting into Waterville, Orondo, and Palisades, some of those school districts are significantly greater than the state average per student. Some of them up to $22,000, $26,000, and $28,000 per student. So my bill, which I've already pre-filed and I think could have some support as it moves through the process, doesn't force anything onto the school districts, but really encourages the smaller school districts to think about joining forces with maybe their smaller sized neighboring district or potentially more medium sized school district. And if they do, which would again be purely voluntary and subject to a careful consideration at the local level and a public process and ultimately votes by the communities. But if the local, if some smaller school districts do decide to voluntarily consolidate, then my bill proposes that they would receive a significant boost in the matching funds to help renovate their school buildings and build new buildings. So, and that, Dave, is something that the smaller school districts tend to say they struggle with anyway, maintaining their facilities and things like that. But also, when you take a closer look at the data indicates that the real cost drivers in these smaller school districts tend to be for administration cost, central maintenance cost, and other sort of business functions. And if you think about it, that tends to be accurate because these smaller school districts each have a superintendent. They each may have a financial officer. They may have someone in human resources. And if we were to really think differently about our school system, sort of redesign it today and start from scratch, I don't think we design 295 different school districts. And so I'm just really encouraging, kind of like that year-round or more balanced school calendar proposal about apportioning school days. I'm just trying to encourage my colleagues and the public to think a little bit differently about our educational delivery system, especially considering how much we're now investing as taxpayers, state and local levy dollars, into the system.
Now, you had provided a graphic. I've got it here again. State average, $13,879. Eastmont's just about $100 less than that. Wenatchee just above that at $14,376. And these were districts in our area. Palisades, $28,745. So that is more than double the state average. Waterville, $18,799. Orondo, just a little more than $22,100. Mansfield, it jumps up to $26,342. Is this typical in other parts of the state? This isn't just an anomaly here in the 12th district, is it?
Right. No, it's not. And I'm not trying to sort of pick on our own district. And I'm really just kind of putting out the facts just so people actually understand. Sometimes people are like, oh, we've probably spent $3,000 or $4,000 per student per year. Oh, no, the state of Washington on average now, due to McCleary and due to the ongoing requests from our local school districts, which are approved by the voters primarily through their levies, it's almost $14,000 a year. And in some of these districts, like you mentioned, it's $25,000, $26,000 per year per student. Now, they have fewer students, so it's more difficult for them to spread some of those costs across. But, you know, if you think about it, it's like, would Orondo school district, and it's not just about costs. I mean, I think the students may actually benefit from some expanded opportunities as well. But why couldn't Orondo and Waterville merge, or Waterville and Mansfield join forces? Or in Chelan County, for example, Manson and Lake Chelan School District. You already have a school district, Lake Chelan. located on Lake Chelan. Manson is also located on the Lake Chelan. I think they're about 6 miles apart. I mean, it's not going to be a significant amount of extra transportation burden to bring those students in. And really, they come in maybe for high school, but they'd still attend their schools in their own like local communities. So I think there are a lot of opportunities. Like Palisades is a good example. They could join forces with Eastmont pretty easily. And the Eastmont administration and front office support could probably absorb Palisades without any hiccup. And it would, I think, help a lot of those students have extra options and really drive down those per student costs as well.
All right. So this will be probably first up through the education committee or the K-12 education committee. Is that the process that this will go through?
It will. We'll receive a hearing on that. And because there are some incentives put in the bill, it would then, if it passes out of the K-12 Education Committee, advance to the Senate Ways and Means Committee for consideration. But what's interesting about those incentives is geared towards facilities, but the cost for the incentives are really sort of one-time expenditures, whereas the cost savings to the taxpayers on the operational side, if we drive down the cost of education, would be ongoing. So I think this bill has gained some attention from some significant people on the budget committee already.
Did you hear about this in your listening tour? Did this come up through that, or what was the genesis of this idea?
Well, I actually thought about it because we work on interim activities and we do research, and some people say, well, what do legislators do in between when they're not in session? Well, obviously there's lots of wildfires, there's other issues, but you work on these bill ideas, and I really wanted to take a look at the data and really kind of dig into it. I do remember some initial conversations years ago when I was the president of the Eastmont School Board about could we do Palisades School District food service? What could we do with Palisades? And I think there are a lot of opportunities, and the ESDs, the educational service districts, try to do a lot where they're, you know, sharing services and collaborating on financial officers and things. But I think there's really nothing keeping the school districts from really doing this now, but also nothing's motivating them to do it. There's no carrot in the process. There's no stick. There's no legislator saying, we're going to force you to consolidate. So I just think there's, hopefully my bill will generate some real positive conversations. It's a way to look at this potentially sticky issue of school consolidations from a slightly different perspective. And hopefully, you know, have some good dialogue. And I look forward to doing that on the committee and then hopefully moving the bill further in the process as well.
We're talking with State Senator Brad Hawkins for the 12th District, and you've got, three more years before you have to run.
That's right.
And the 12th District will look entirely different by the time you run.
At least half of it.
Yeah, your counterparts, though, over in the House, Keith Gaynor and Mike Steele, have to run next summer. And the 12th District now is going to move over into portions of Snohomish and King counties and loses the Methow Valley, for instance. So places that have been part of the 12th District for a very, very long time, and a portion of Douglas County as well. So I'm looking forward to a chance to talk with them, but because it affects them sooner. But now you've got to sort of represent people on two sides of the Cascades now. What do you see that as a challenge for you? And now all of a sudden, wait a minute, our 12th District representative is that guy from over in East mm-hmm. Wenatchee. Mm-hmm. Whereas some people here go, wait a minute, our congresswoman here is that lady from over in Sammamish. So, you know, you sort of, we all kind of look at our representation and is that our local person? We all tend to do that.
Right. And the mountain range is certainly creates some significant challenges geographically. And I think for people philosophically as well. I mean, three of the challenges with that district are Stevens Pass, Blewett Pass, and Snoqualmie Pass. But yeah, as you described it, the 12th District would lose the Okanagan County portion of the constituents, as well as some of Grant County and most of the Douglas County, at least geographically. It would include a portion of the East Wenatchee addresses. It basically mirrors, in some respect, the city of East Wenatchee city limits, but then all of Chelan County over into, as you mentioned, portion of Snohomish County and a portion of King, primarily Gold Bar, Sultan, Monroe, that community up Highway 2 into Snohomish County, and then North Bend and part of Carnation and other communities in the more rural portion of King County. I pride myself in being able to represent everybody and working hard regardless of where they're at. That's why I always made trips to the listening tour up the Mehow Valley and in the far reaches of the district. And I really, my office prides itself in our constituent customer service. My philosophy is that these positions exist to serve the people who elect you, but it is going to be different. And I'm going to be working really hard to reach out to those areas and sort of introduce myself over the next several years so that they have a good understanding of what I am, and also so that they feel that they have access to their legislator. But I am quite disappointed with the final redistricting process. I think our communities did everything right in terms of sharing public comments and communicating the importance of keeping Chelan and Douglas counties together, or shared natural resources and economic interest. But in the end, it just seems like the redistricting commissioners disregarded the public comments that were received overwhelmingly and created a map in the end just to balance out the populations anyway, that didn't resemble in any way anything like any of their previous proposals. So it's really disappointing. And in some ways, it's almost as if we have three districts. You know, we have the Chelan County and East Wenatchee portion, and then there's the Snohomish portion with Monroe and that community, and then North Bend. So I think it's not that they don't always connect with what we are, but there's almost like, I don't think Monroe as a community shares common interest with North Bend either, because they're pretty far apart and there's just different needs and different perspectives. So I'll be working hard. It'll be a challenge, but I look forward to doing that over the next several years.
You're going to have to learn about dairy.
Oh, yeah. You know, the 12th dairy. District has always been like the hydropower, tree fruit, tourism, outdoor recreation. That's been sort of the base of our economy and district, but it'll be different. And I'm warming up to that. And like I said, I think we do a really good job of constituent customer service, and the listening tours, of course, will be very different, but I will embrace that wholeheartedly. And the legislature ultimately has to approve these redistricting maps, but we could make some changes by a two-thirds approval, but it's really within a couple few thousand people. So it's not significantly going to change those maps.
Once they are approved, when do the new borders take effect?
I think the new borders take effect soon after they're approved, which will be, for example, in February. But they become more noticeable during the August and November 2022 elections, primary and general. And then it's after that process that I can officially use my office resources to reach out to those people. So it's kind of a confusing situation. And also for, I should say, the Douglas County portion of the district and the Okanagan County portion of the district that is moving, or soon will be, from the 12th legislative district to the 7th. There's kind of a limbo period right now where legislators are prohibited from using their office resources and email newsletters and mailings to their district to kind of share that information, because the elections are right around the corner for, I think, half of the Senate and also approximately all of the state House members. So they're all up for
election. I was reading some reporting out of the Mehow Valley, and folks up there feel like they are more closely associated with the 12th district of Chelan Douglas County than they are with their neighbors to the northeast, and as they join the 7th district. So I thought that was a little bit surprising. I sort of thought of them more, you know, more Okanagan and Okanagan County and associated to the northeast, but they say they're sort of feeling the same way as the 12th district folks will feel about losing the portions they are and then moving the district into Western Washington.
Right. And if you think about the Mehow Valley, they're primarily an outdoor recreation tourism economy with their hiking and rafting and cross-country skiing in the winter. I mean, they have a lot in common with other tourism economies like Chelan, Leavenworth, and to some respect to Wenatchee Valley. And you know, they don't always have the farming and ag and the range work that the other portions of Okanagan County have. So they were very disappointed. And I'm pleased to say they really like us as 12th District legislators. I mean, we've worked really hard to form a historical relationship with them, to understand their issues. It takes a lot of work to really dig into these issues. And all of that information, even though those legislators from the 7th District are very capable, I serve with them, but it's going to take time for them to learn those issues. And the 7th, if you look at the geographical boundaries of the 7th Legislative District, it almost rivals a congressional district. You had Reagan Dunn on your show. I heard that a couple days ago. And I wouldn't be surprised if that 7th Legislative District is as large or larger as his congressional district that he's running for. So it presents some challenges. I just hope in my heart that the people of Douglas County and other areas in Okanagan County don't get marginalized in this process. And for example, like the Wenatchee Valley doesn't lose access to funding over time, because when it comes to some of these transportation projects that I have been supportive of, they're now outside my district or outside my future district. And I have to think as a member of the Transportation Committee about the needs in Monroe and Highway 2 and what transportation needs North Bend has. So I'm still very much supportive, for example, of the Confluence Parkway Bridge that the city of Wenatchee is supporting. But when it comes to our other regional transportation priorities, honestly, I have to kind of rethink that, because I need to advocate for the other areas of the district. They deserve that just as much as, you know, members of the district do here. So I'm going to be going to bat for them as well.
Yeah, interesting. Well, folks are wondering, in fact, even being solicited to sign up for Initiative 1436, long-term care tax, to try and get that initiative to the legislature. But this is the long-term care tax that is just, no matter how you slice it, it's just not a good deal for most folks. Now I'm hearing that it may get pushed back to January 2023, that even Democrats are trying to talk to the governor about that. What are you hearing? Because a lot of folks are about to start getting another deduction out of their paycheck here in just a short month from now.
Right. Yeah, it'll be interesting. It does appear as if the Democrats now are coming around to at least acknowledging some of the troubles that we were acknowledging as Senate Republicans when we were debating the legislation a couple of years ago. And the Speaker of the House, Lori Jenkins, has asked the governor to essentially delay the implementation of the whole program. And she was the prime sponsor of the bill, I believe, was from 2019, the original legislation. I think her intent is to have the governor delay it, and then for the legislature in the 2022 session here, beginning in next month, to make some adjustments and reforms and modifications to the program to sort of make it more workable. But it does jeopardize whether or not it can actually be fully implemented this way, if even the Democratic leaders in the House and Senate are openly and publicly acknowledging there's problems with it.
So what this initiative 1436 would propose to do is actually give you an opt-out option, which you no longer have at this point. So what they're talking about is maybe delaying implementation. But I've not heard whether any sort of opt-out option is included in
there,
that.
There's no opt-out. I mean, there can't be. I mean, basically, we've even said, well, it's not portable, so people can pay into the system for... It's not really paying into the system. There's a payroll tax, so they're paying a payroll tax and to grow government to fund this program, but they could pay that for several years and then move out of state and retirement and not be eligible for anything. So it's not portable. It's not like any of these, some of these other long-term plans. But then after a while, after sort of essentially banging my head against the wall, trying to understand this proposal and the law that was passed, you kind of have to step back and realize, you know, it's not really intended to be a program that's workable. It's intended to be a new tax. It's a tax on your paycheck for all the workers, even the young workers who are struggling to pay off student loans or saving for that down payment on a house, and for everybody, you know, to be taxed in this way, to go into a government fund that they call basically a trust fund. But all the different things, the way it didn't make sense, I think they knew that. It's just basically another justification for a tax. And it obviously, the only thing long-term about this, Dave, is the tax. The actual benefit is pretty short-term when you think about the cost of long-term care. And I don't mean in any way to diminish long-term care. I mean, it's a very significant. It's almost like, unfortunately, like cancer. I mean, everybody has some association with some family member in long-term care. So it's a very, very important issue. But this approach at the state level is not workable. And now the Democrats know that. And I think the governor even acknowledged that. So it'll be interesting to see what transpires this legislative session about it. But knowing that it was the Speaker of the House's piece of legislation before she was Speaker of the House, and now she's Speaker of the House, I'm sure she's going to put a lot of her political capital into, you know, figuring out some sort of solution for it.
Well, if people are interested in making sure or trying to ensure that this opt-out option comes before the legislature, don't be counting on these delays that are being floated out there right now. If you're interested, you want to get a hold of one of those 1436 initiatives and get it signed as they bring that to the legislature. Let's talk a little bit about, I've got so many notes here, dropping them on the floor here.
Your stack of stuff.
Yeah, my stack of stuff here. Is Washington State capable of providing broad-based tax relief is a question that the Washington Policy Center raised, and they pointed out $7.7 billion, almost $8 billion, is how much state revenue is projected to increase over a four-year period. And so they put out a position that tax relief should focus on the state sales tax rate, that the state sales tax, and I'm just reading some from information that they had, started in 1935. It was 2%. Boy, the good old days.
Mm-hmm.
1935, 2% sales tax. Now it is 6.5%. And the last time there was a reduction was in 1982. Mm-hmm. Were you alive in 1982?
Yes, I was, actually.
Okay. Just barely.
Yeah, right.
Just barely. I was alive a long time ago, well before that. But it's been since 1982 since we've had a sales tax reduction. And dropping it down to 6% would provide approximately $1.5 billion in tax relief and still leave billions in revenues and funds available for either targeted spending increases and complying with the four-year budget outlook. So they raised the point, if not now, when? Because it is those revenues are going up at about a 45-degree angle on the chart. If you look at it, it's just year over year, it's 13% above last year.
Oh, yeah. And I think now would be a great time. Also, when the revenues are up, it's actually a good time to look at maybe rolling back that capital gains income tax or possibly having a manufacturing tax credit or having some property tax relief. You know, that's been a big issue, too. But when it comes to the sales tax, I think that's a good proposal because it's a regressive tax. There's no doubt about it. And meaning that the lower income portion of the population pays a disproportionately higher burden in tax through the sales tax. And fuel taxes are the same way. And now that we have this extra revenue, if the Senate and House majorities were truly interested in reforming our regressive system of taxes, maybe they'd want to lower these. But one of my challenges and concerns is that the state budget the spending has significantly increased too. And I'm just not confident that the state budget, the level of spending can be sustained too. So either reducing the state sales tax or using a lot of these extra revenues to shore up our budget stabilization account or some of these other things, because I'm just afraid the economy's been really roaring for several years. And if it does take a downturn, most of our revenues in the state are sales tax and a portion property tax and B&O taxes. But, I mean, our revenues are going to take a hit if the economy takes a dip. And when that happens, a lot of the state spending has to be adjusted accordingly. Or, on the flip side, some of my colleagues across the aisle will probably say, well, if the revenues take a dip, we probably need to look at more taxes to make up for it. So I think Washington Policy Center brings up a good point, and hopefully they can gain some traction with this, and that would reduce the regressivity of our tax system, a reduction in the sales tax.
Well, if we can't restrain our spending, the only other way to do it is to get some austerity, is to slow that spigot down. And right. So if we do this, again, that's just a modest reduction down to 6%. Mm-hmm. And that saves $1.5 billion right there that we're all paying out of our pocket.
Right.
Even if you're rich.
Yeah.
You know, you don't like to pay any more sales tax than you have to. And then your local taxes are built upon that.
Oh, and all pancakes and federal, of course. But, you know, if we could get back in the majority again in the Senate, I would love to get my hands on the budget, because there's a variety of other reforms that I'd like to make. So, for example, I serve on the Transportation Committee, and the transportation budget funds, road projects and other things. But it also funds the day-to-day operations of the State Patrol, the Washington DOT and other, you know, Department of Licensing, actually funds the operating expenses of those entities who are state employees. I'd love to have the operating budget pick up a portion of those costs from our transportation budget, so our transportation budget would have more funding for roads and bridges and other maintenance and preservation needs. And so there are a whole host of different reform ideas that, you know, I'd love to make. Also, the operating budget, just speaking of transportation, the operating budget collects all the sales tax revenue from vehicle sales. And I kind of think, well, the revenues from the vehicle sales should go to the transportation budget to help fund improvements for our roads and bridges and maintenance and preservation needs. So I think something like a reduction in sales tax, or some reforms on the property tax, or building up our rainy day fund, or making some of these other reforms that are long overdue. I mean, when the revenues are up, it creates an opportunity to do that. But on the flip side, what it also creates an opportunity to do is for some of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle to create new programs and more spending and things like that. And it's a challenge. But for example, why do we need to collect payroll tax for the long-term care if the sales taxes are so great? You know, maybe there's some adjustments there, but it remains to be seen what, if anything, will actually be reformed. But when you do look at the historical state budget, it has grown and almost doubled in the past 10 years.
We're talking to State Senator Brad Hawkins from the 12th District. And when the legislature gets underway, of course, last year we had the comprehensive sex education bill. Are there any big could be considered controversial social programs that you're hearing legislators might bring forth in this session?
Well, I'm not sure. I think last legislative session, there were major policy proposals that, you know, whether it was a host of police reform activities, that governor's climate cap and invest, cap and trade piece of legislation, there was significant reforms and bills that basically would increase taxes like the capital gains to pay for expanded child care and other things. And so I believe the Democratic members probably did a clean sweep this last legislative session, because they had the long session, the governor was in place, they had expanded majorities in both the House and Senate. Those expanded majorities are returning, but we also have, you know, other things to deal with this session. I'm certainly hoping we can make some adjustments to those police reforms to make those more workable for our courageous men and women in law enforcement, and then also make some modest adjustments to the budget that kind of bring our spending more in line with what I think our revenues will be sustainable revenues in the future. So I'm really hoping that my Democratic colleagues aren't pushing too hard on a bunch of new controversial proposals, and that we can kind of make some modest adjustments, entertain some smaller pieces of legislation, and get out of there on time.
You'll be together at least And so I'm sure the minority party is going to want to bring up executive powers.
Right, that's another
mandates.
Thing.
Mandates. I'm sure they're going to at least bring that up. You may not have the votes to try and force any sort of changes, but whereas this whole last year, since last spring, you haven't had a voice. You haven't had a forum to do that.
Right. I want to do that. I've actually co-sponsored a piece of legislation to reform the state's emergency powers. Basically, it would require the governor to come back to the legislature for legislative approval after 30 days or 60 days of a declared emergency. It's really interesting that the governor is utilizing basically the emergency statute that's put in place some years ago for things that we thought were like the Oso mudslide and the Cascadia earthquake and wildfires and flash floods, to kind of use that to justify ongoing executive action. So it'll be interesting with Governor Inslee whether he will entertain any adjustments to emergency powers, or if that's something that may need to be done after he leaves office. But I think he's talking about maybe a third term at some point, or fourth term, I guess I should say. I've lost track. So that'll be interesting. And then just going back to this session, I think the dynamics could be different, not so much in the Senate, but in the House of Representatives. All of the members of the State House of Representatives are up for election, kind of like you talked about early on in the show. And so I think they're going to be eager to kind of wrap it up and maybe not be too controversial this year. So we'll see. It'll be a big election cycle too, with midterm elections. So for some of the things Reagan Dunn talked about, those indicators. So maybe not too controversial this year, to answer your question. My guess anyway.
As we brace ourselves for another wildfire season coming up next year, we've got our little break right now. There's been a lot of work on wildfire preparedness and funding for all of that. You've been a part of that with some legislation. Again, where are we at on this plan to better fund the ability to go out and fight wildfires and not borrow from Peter to pay Paul? Right. So give us a little update on that and how we are heading into next season.
Right. Well, we've had some real challenges in Washington State with our wildfires, and it's been sort of decades in the making with the overabundance of trees, and, the warmer climate is presenting some challenges too. We have to get to a situation, though, to your question, where we can put out the fires soon after they start, rather than just managing the fires once they get burning. So we need to increase our air assets. We've been doing that. The legislation that passed last year that Commissioner Hillary Franz of the DNR has worked so hard on, and her staff, it does set a goal of funding wildfire response and resiliency about $500 million over the next several years. So the legislature will need to continue to fund the wildfire in accordance with that bill. But one of the things, and I just had a lunch, just she and I, a couple weeks ago, and we had a good conversation about it. One of the things that Bill helped with and DNR was able to do is secure the air assets on a contractual basis with private aircraft, so that Washington State would be sort of have the first right of refusal. And what we're getting in a situation in the West and even into British Columbia where we can't always get the resources. So we either need to build up our own or secure strategically some contractual obligations with some of these private aircraft. And when you have Commissioner France on the agenda here in a couple weeks or whatever, you should ask her about what she did with that. That was a really good move. So we're making progress. It was another difficult year in the Methow Valley with wildfires up there, and obviously the fire on Sunny Slope earlier this year. But hopefully we can get to a point with forest management where we're harvesting the trees, clearing out the underbrush, creating jobs, and also minimizing our risk of catastrophic wildfire at the same time. So it's a combination of both, increasing their air assets and their resources and the year-round personnel, but then also continuing to be aggressive and strategic about forest management.
All right. I know that she also is pushing for more funding for reforestation,
right,
trying to plant more trees.
Yeah, we talked about that too. I mean, we're burning up, so if we want to kind of care about our natural resources, we need to consider planting more trees too. So we need to plant them the right way, and if some have overgrown in some areas, we need to clear out the small diameter trees, hopefully have a small diameter lumber mill at some point in north central Washington. So we can, and then really, there's only so much the state can do. We really also need the U.S. Forest Service to be a good partner and an active partner. They have so much land, especially in Chelan County, to really allow the state and other entities to kind of clear out some of the trees, the overabundance of trees on U.S. Forest Service land.
Well, we really started to see the aerial response on a much quicker basis.
Right.
And this red, the rooster fire here, that was probably the most best example. I mean, there were so many planes in the air, you couldn't count them.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas we didn't see that just a few short years ago. So they've really ramped that up.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's encouraging to hear that we've got even more plans to beef up the air attack.
Building up our own Washington State air assets so we control those, and also continuing to contract with the private aircraft to make sure we get sort of preference, you know, if we need it. And, you know, that might cost us a little bit more, but I think it pays off in the end. We're starting to see that.
For folks that want to be in touch with your office as the legislative session gets underway, what's the best way to do that?
The best way to do that is through my website. It's SenatorBradHawkins.org. Again, that's SenatorBradHawkins.org. While they're on my website, they can read about my news releases. We have a whole history of past email newsletters that we've sent out and other links to information, how to track bills. But we also have a contact me page, which has a form people can fill out and populate. Click submit, and that comes instantaneously to my office. There'll be three of us in the office working remotely this year, as well as myself. So if people have questions, concerns about state government, please contact us. Hopefully we can get back to you pretty quickly. Sometimes during the legislative session, Dave, we get upwards of 300 or 400 emails a day. So that just gives you a sense of, you know, one day into the next and through the weekends. But we really work hard to prioritize our constituents' questions and get back to them promptly. So you might even get a phone call from my intern, who's a former Apple Blossom princess, who will be joining us. We also have a session aide that'll be joining us. He's a Waterville college student whose home is Waterville. So we have some folks from the district too. And you might get a chance to talk to them. You might even get a postcard from me. So feel free to reach out to me on SenatorBradHawkins.org.
All right. We'll be talking to you probably in the new year and definitely on our Friday call, I think, during the legislative session. So Merry Christmas to your family.
Likewise to you, Dave, and to all the KPU listeners out there. Thank you for the opportunity to serve as your 12th District State Senator, and Merry Christmas.